top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. Going to be a big week, big day coming up. Pete Hegseth is traveling to Panama for big meetings with them to make sure that China is out of that canal. They are pushing back. House lawmakers will review the DOGE team's efforts to reduce federal government and their real estate footprint. So we know about that. I want to see how much money they sent. I cannot wait for the cross-examination of it. As we hear a lot about how DOGE is overestimating what they've really done. Good. Let them stand up and show what they've done. They actually list it on their website. So before we get to more of that, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's been a bad 3 weeks for the Houthis, and it's about to get worse. It's been a devastating campaign, whether it's underground facilities, weapons manufacturing, bunkers, troops in the open, air defense assets. We are not going to relent.
Middle East turmoil. The president's decision to pound the Houthis has helped Iran militias to put down their arms and convince them to do just that and keep going. Iran's regime is going to the table to talk with us on Saturday. This, along with the latest on the Gaza situation, with the IDF controlling 50% of that strip of land.
Number two.
This is a massive legal victory, Jesse, a massive victory for law and order and for our constitutional republic and the sovereignty of the United States of America.
So many times it's going to happen. Judge Fair has landed in the lap of the Supreme Court. And for the Trump, the results were two wins. And the president gets the green light to ship TDA to El Salvador. But there's a catch.
Number one.
Virtually every country wants to negotiate. If I didn't do what I did over the last couple of weeks, you wouldn't have anybody wants to negotiate. We would have gone to these countries who want to talk, and they were, well, we don't want to talk. Now they're coming to us.
The Trump tariffs have gotten the entire world's attention, and the offers of new deals are flooding in. The question for me in the markets, does the president want to do a deal? And with whom? Because he's doubling, tripling down on China, which I think you should be able to support. Anyone who's been paying attention since 2000, they had in 2000, before they joined the WTO, they had 6% of the world's manufacturing. Now they got 32%. It is stunning. And a lot of it's made off our money, because the word was that America was moving past manufacturing. We didn't want to do those jobs anymore. Well, someone tell the Rust Belt, they're now the Rust Belt because of that. So let's begin with negotiations. As I hope, my fingers are crossed, negotiations as it comes to tariffs. Right now, the markets are up significantly. How about over 1,000 points? We're closing in on 40,000 again. Why? Because Scott Bessent is making it clear that they're looking to negotiate, saying Japan will be first because they were the first to belly up to the bar. Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday saying, we are cutting it down to zero tariffs, and we're looking for the world to do what we're doing with America. Cut three.
First, if I can mention tariffs, it's a subject of some interest today. I can tell you that I said to the president a very simple thing. We will eliminate the trade deficit with the United States. We intend to do it very quickly. We think it's the right thing to do. And we're going to also eliminate trade barriers, a variety of trade barriers that have been put up unnecessarily. And I think Israel can serve as a model for many countries who ought to do the same.
It's kind of interesting because the EU came back yesterday and they said zero tariffs. You know what the president said? Yeah, not good enough. So what's not good enough? The fact they don't take our beef. What's good enough? A lot of these European countries don't take our cars. Here's what Scott Bessent said that had people thinking to themselves, wow, we might have a series of deals coming down. Cut five.
I haven't seen anything from them, but Larry, I can tell you that there are 50, 60, maybe almost 70 countries now who have approached us. So it's going to be a busy April, May, maybe into June. And Japan is a very important military ally. They're a very important economic ally. And the U.S. has a lot of history with them. So I would expect that Japan's going to get priority, just because they came forward very quickly. But it's going to be very busy. And if President Trump, again, gave himself maximum negotiating leverage. And just when he achieved the maximum leverage, he's willing to start talking.
So right now we know the Prime Minister of Italy, Meloni, is coming into town next week. Vietnam said we're looking to cut tariffs to zero right away, although that's a little bit different because their trade imbalance is so imbalanced with us. But I like it, too, because by reports, looks like Vietnam does a ton of textile work for us and some tech work that we want to get out of China. So we'll see what happens. This is what the Treasury Secretary is saying. A little bit of a problem that Mark Lutnick and Peter Navarro are saying something different. Oh, we're not looking to do deals. I think the President of the United States should be the one talking then. If I have no idea if Lutnick is on the same page with the president or Scott Bessent, makes me think that he's such a buttoned-up guy. It seems to me he wouldn't be hopping on with Larry Kudlow, a close friend of the president's, to make that statement if he was shooting from the hip. So we'll see where it goes. Now, in Congress, in the Senate side, about seven senators have signed off saying that they want a say on the president's tariffs. Of course, if it does ever pass the Senate, it'll get stopped in the House. And if it does pass, get through the House, the president will veto it. But they're trying to send a message that the Congress spends the money and you shouldn't be doing that without talking unless it's an emergency. That's where the rubber hits the road. The president says it's an emergency. And there's a lot of people now who are panicked over the weekend and not happy on Monday who are seeing what's happening now with the market and saying, well, wait a second. The president is trying to negotiate massively, which is so typical of the way he's handled this term so far, just 4 months in. He's not waiting. Why do you think there is the tariffs? At the same time, we got the minerals conversation going on with Ukraine today. At the same time, he's agreed to have talks with Iran on Saturday in Oman. At the same time, we're bombing the Houthi rebels on a daily basis. At the same time, delivering 2,000-pound bombs to Israel, knowing that they very well could be used in Iran to blow up their nuclear program like they did in Iraq in the 1980s. But so far, the Speaker Johnson says, hold on. This is what Trump said he wanted to do. I'm giving him space. Cut seven.
I think you got to give the president the latitude, the runway to do what it is he was elected to do, and that is get this economy going again and get our trade properly balanced with other countries. So I think most of the American people understand the necessity of that. Listen, we had a $1.2 trillion trade deficit in 2024. I don't think that's fair to our country. I think the American people understand that, and I think they see a president who's engaging and trying to fix that. So we're going to give him the space necessary to do it.
And we'll see where it goes. So I mentioned lawfare to start the show. That's exactly what's happening. I call it judge fair because they try to find a judge to challenge a president's executive order, and they pulled everything up. The first thing was on when it comes to TDA, this judge, Boasberg, comes out and says, I don't want anyone flying to El Salvador. We're going to put this whole thing on hold until I can find out who's on that plane, who's on the next plane, and why you didn't turn it around when I told you to over that weekend day. Now, you're a district judge. Who are you to set policy? That's where the standoff has been. So they worked their way from an appellate court to the Supreme Court. And yesterday, the judge fair went the president's way, saying the detainees are allowed to be shipped overseas because this is an emergency. The 1794 proclamation stands up. That was used back then. So they say technically it is a state of war and emergency. However, the detainees must be given time to challenge their detention and deportation via habeas corpus claim and be able to challenge whether or not they're being acted upon illegally or not. Now, I'm all for making sure the right people are on that plane. It doesn't work to anyone's advantage for you send the wrong people to El Salvador, but I got it, or El Salvador or Venezuela or anywhere. But I got a huge problem if you're going to hold up and burden our system with illegals that came here, obviously illegally, to commit crimes here, that's the accusation, who come forward and actually put the initials many times on their bodies through tattoos. Now I got to ask a judge, and then you got to ask a defendant to go get an attorney, at which time we're going to see the case, dare I say, appeal the case. So that's what bothers me. We have our own Americans committing crimes looking for their day in court. Now we got illegals here wreaking havoc who don't care whether they're caught or not, obviously, because most likely they were committing crimes in their native country. Stephen Miller, Cut 14, sees nothing but a win.
What does this mean for you and your family watching at home tonight? It means that the Department of Justice, FBI, DEA, ATF, the U.S. Marshals Service, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement now have maximum authority to find and remove illegal alien gang members from Venezuela that have been responsible for so much misery in this country, for the torture and murder of Jocelyn Nungery, for the brutal slaying of Lake and Riley. Those monsters can now be hunted down and expelled from this country with speed, force, and efficiency.
So we'll see what happens. They're building the wall. The border slowed down to a trickle, pressuring Central and South American countries not to come, making sure Panama shuts off the Darien Pass, making it harder and harder to get up. Mexico must be doing something right, or their southern border must be really reinforced, because there's a reason why they're not getting to our southern border. And I don't think it's because we're building another 20 miles of wall. I think the message is out. You're not going to want to come here, especially if you commit a crime. They like committing crimes. They just don't like paying the time for doing their crimes. And now they're seeing the miserable life those criminals are living over in El Salvador. I don't think anybody wants that. So when we come back, I'll talk about what's happening in the Middle East. Stunning news with Iran, totally caught by surprise. But the ripple effects go all the way back to possibly leading up to the Abraham Accords. I'll discuss that when we come back. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor, editor-at-large of The Spectator, and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. I'm inviting you to join in-depth conversations every week on the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It should absolutely be looked at for prosecution the exact same way as the other two individuals you name. Kevin O'Connor told the New York Post that Joe Biden was excellent 4 days before Joe Biden dropped out. Kevin O'Connor said the man did not need a cognitive test to the New York Post after the Robert Hur report, who sat across from him and saw all sorts of frailties. Kevin O'Connor said it was normal that the Parkinson's doctor came to the White House 8 times. He only saw Biden 3 or 4 of those times. Kevin O'Connor has a lot of questions to answer. He needs to go before Congress, and if he doesn't do so willingly, well, they set a precedent for what happens to you.
So Kayleigh McEnany yesterday on Outnumbered, which I was on, just ran through all the problems this guy Kevin O'Connor. Now, who is he? He's the White House doctor, and he's been a family doctor to the Bidens. Look, you're entitled to your privacy as a president. I get it. But not as a consequence of serving. I mean, obviously, if this guy's 45 years old, Barack Obama, prime of his life, people go, okay, you know, let me know if there's a problem. But when you're 82 years old, looking like you're 92 or 102, unable to do your job or really get on and off a stage, know what direction you're in, or finish a sentence, and then you have a situation what happened at the debate, my goodness. Of course people had questions, but you had a doctor standing in the way saying, my credentials, got a degree, there is no problem. Now you have these at least 2 books out that talked about how this guy epically failed behind closed doors, how people had a death pool for him with Kamala Harris's camp. That's how confident they were he would survive. Here is Ronnie Jackson. He's going to call Dr. Kevin O'Connor forward. He's a congressman now in Texas, but he was once the White House doctor for Bush, Obama, and Trump. 24.
I was saying it when he was candidate Joe Biden back in 2020 when he was running, that this man's not cognitively fit to be our commander-in-chief and our head of state. And they knew it. And now the books are proven that they knew it back then. They just kept their mouth shut. They covered it up and they lied to the American people. He was auto-penning everything he was signing. Who was running the country, Laura? Who? We don't know.
I mean, was it Jeff Zients, his chief of staff? Was it Hunter Biden, his chief confidant? And I'm not kidding. They say in these books, and there's no doubt about it, he was with them every step of the way. You saw what Hunter was doing over in Ireland on his overseas trip. Who knows? We still don't know whose cocaine it was in the White House, but you have your suspicions. So was Hunter his main confidant? Was Jill? Was Jake Sullivan? Was Anthony Blinken, who weren't speaking to each other? Who was running the country? We thought that after Woodrow Wilson was exposed that he had a stroke and his wife ran the country and everybody covered for him, that would never happen again. But it did happen. And I'm just curious. I want to look forward. we have so many things going on in the Trump era and so many problems to solve, but we should find out who was complicit and who was making these decisions, who was actually programming the auto pen. How about that? So now people are starting to get questions, even from friendly people in the media, like Kristen Welker of Meet the Press. Listen to how Adam Schiff handled it when asked about the health of one Joe Biden. He said it was mostly ceremonial. Here's cut 26.
Do you think that former President Biden's advisors misled the American people about his capacities?
It's hard for me to gauge what the closest advisors of the president were seeing at the time. I can only speak to the interactions that I had with him, which were, in the months leading up to his getting out of the race, largely ceremonial occasions.
Such a cop-out. Please, you have to hold this guy to the fire. Remember Gavin Newsom said things like this, too? And I was just asking, I just remember one of Tim Walz's main jobs when he was just governor of Minnesota was to defend Joe Biden. He loved defending Biden. His guy is unbelievably accomplished. He's going to destroy Donald Trump. He is sharp. He's on top of his game. So I'll see where that goes. But overall, that's what really damaged the Democratic brand. The way he led, his invisibility on the world stage, his projection of weakness around the world. And now we hear that all he wanted to do was talk about how the NATO countries respected him, as if he wanted to be president of NATO. So good luck with that. We'll see where it goes. So yesterday was announced Saturday, the president of the United States will send a delegation higher up. Now, not clear after talking to State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce today on TV if it's going to be the Secretary of State, but it could be Steve Witkoff or somebody else. We'll have direct/indirect talks with Iran about their nuclear program. This is unbelievable because about a month ago, President Trump gave them a letter essentially saying either you take apart your nuclear program or we will. And they said they don't respond to threats. Then they said they only want indirect talks. Now it looks like both sides will be in the same room, just not be in the same building, just not in the same room to talk directly. I think there's going to be an intermediary. Here's cut 15.
We're having direct talks with Iran. They've started. It'll go on Saturday. We have a very big meeting, and we'll see what can happen. And I think everybody agrees that doing a deal would be preferable to doing the obvious. And the obvious is not something that I want to be involved with or, frankly, that Israel wants to be involved with if they can avoid it.
Right, but Israel knows they got to do what they did in 1980, stop Saddam Hussein from having a nuclear weapon, even though Ronald Reagan said don't do it. So this time, I think if they walk away from, or if they start slow walking the talks and giving them, and there's an intelligence says that they're building a nuclear weapon, I think that Israel just takes it upon themselves with a wink and a nod from us. So the Trump insisted the talks were direct, but there, the Iranian spokesman claimed they would be indirect. In diplomatic terms, that means mediators pass notes back and forth on both sides are in the same building. I don't know. I want to see Rubio take the lead here. He understands the situation top to bottom, and he obviously understands Trump. Colonel Alan West next.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
It was a pleasant surprise, and I will say that I'm happy about this conclusion that, of course, the Trump administration has this jurisdiction. This is their responsibility. This is what people voted for. We cannot be constrained by judicial tyranny. And so I'm glad that they are taking this seriously and that this conclusion went the way that the country needs it to go.
And what they did is allows the country by recognizing the act that the act of 1794, the looks like the Supreme Court has said by a 5-4 decision, it looks like Amy Coney Barrett went the other way, has allowed President Trump to ship these illegal immigrant criminals to other countries. Okay, got it. But the problem is, I don't see necessarily a problem. I just don't have the solution that they get their day in court. And then they're going to get a lawyer. And then, you know, there's going to be an appeal. And a lot of times with these illegal alien criminals, you don't have the textbook proof. And yet we're giving all these criminals rights of an American citizen. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. Colonel, your thoughts about what the Supreme Court did yesterday?
Well, I think you have to give them kudos on one point, like you just said, and then you have to scratch your head on the other. And it's great to be with you, Brian, because I don't understand how you extend constitutional rights to people that are here illegally that are members of a gang or a terrorist organization, and they have committed criminal acts while they're here illegally. If anything, they have to be looked at as non-state, non-uniform belligerents in our country, violating our sovereignty and our rights, and they should be expeditiously taken out of this country. Because now, all you're going to do is elongate the process because they're going to lawyer up, and a bunch of George Soros-backed far-left organizations are going to support them legally, and they're just going to muck up the system.
I think so, too. You know, and obviously these idiots, either they wear the MS-13 did a great job wearing the 1980s or 1990s Bulls jerseys, and these guys put tattoos on them. That's how proud they are. Not all of them, but a lot of them. So, I mean, that's not proof enough. You can't just say, well, that looks like a criminal. Well, that tattoo is a criminal tattoo. So I can't say that. But I do worry about the whole situation. Now, the ICE agents got to be detectives. They make the arrests, and they got to break it down, and they got to secure the scene and get all these evidence. And to me, it's just not practical, I don't think.
No, it's not practical. And look, it's just the same as on the battlefield, how we start to turn the battlefield into a law enforcement operation instead of a combat operation when we're saying that we have to collect evidence against people that are out there, you know, doing terrorist actions, and we have to treat them with certain rights. And look, Guantanamo Bay is a great example. If you are, as I say, a non-state, non-uniform belligerent captured on the battlefield, even the Geneva Convention does not offer you, you know, too many rights. So why are we starting to extend these type of rights to individuals that, once again, in some of these jurisdictions in the country, they still want to protect them. They still don't want to work with ICE to, you know, get these people deported. And now we're going to allow them to have, you know, lawyers and things of this nature. So what happens in that meantime? I mean, are they still held or do they get to, you know, be released? And do they have these lawyers going to be working with them? And like you say, all of these appeals. We have to start looking at this as a violation, again, of our nation.
Well,
people that are taking actions against us.
So,
like, you know,
so let me ask you this,
Chinese.
Colonel. What do you say to people who are listening to us right now who are here legally and they're worried about being scooped up and sent to an El Salvador prison when they're for mistaken identity? And that was not what type of thing that would come out in court. What do you say to people like that?
Well, I think if you're here legally, why should you have anything to worry about? That's like saying if I'm doing, you know, everything that's right, why should I be worried about doing something that is wrong? I know that the left are talking about this guy who, you know, he's a father and all of this type of stuff. But yeah, he's a member of a criminal gang, the Trinidad Robber Gang. You have Mahmoud Khalil. Once again, he is a person that came here as a guest to this country on a visa, and he is inciting violence and supporting an organization that has killed Americans and taken Americans hostage. And why should he get to stay here in America? Why should he have due process? The first thing he should be shown is an airplane.
I hope so. I'm going to talk to Jonathan Turley in about 15 minutes about it, so we'll see where that goes. The president's tariffs are in full swing, but he seems to be looking to do a deal now. Wall Street's convinced of it. I think the market's up 1,064 points, a little bit different than yesterday and the day before and the day before that. Here's the president on what he plans on doing and how he wants to really focus on China. Cut one.
I have great respect for China, but they can't do this. We're going to have one shot at this, and no other president's going to do this, what I'm doing. And I'll tell you what, it's an honor to do it because we have been just destroyed what they've done to our system. You know, we have $36 trillion of debt for a reason. And the reason is that people allowed it to get that way. So we'll be talking to China. We'll be talking to a lot of different countries. And I think, you know, if we can make a really fair deal and a good deal for the United States, not a good deal for others. This is America first. It's now America first. And we didn't put America first. We put America last. The people that were in the Oval Office put America last, and we're not going to stand for it.
So China, as you know, turned around and retaliated on Friday with 34% tariffs. He said, basically, you do that again or you up it again, we're going to double it up to 100%. And if you take all the president's pledges, it's 104% tariffs on China, whose manufacturing has hollowed out American industry, and they desperately need the American consumer. And don't let anybody tell you they're economically, they're not reeling, because they are.
Yeah, they are. And I think you have to have a little history lesson here. The Chinese recognize that the United States defeated the Soviet Union economically, not militarily. And they vowed somehow to make sure that that did not happen to them, that they can continue to be a communist country. So what happens? They get themselves into the WTO. They get most favored trade nation status. We start bringing in all of these cheap Chinese goods, something that I had to deal with as a member of Congress with the Chinese drywall issue down in South Florida, where it was actually poisoning people. Now we got them shipping fentanyl in here. So they have taken this economic boon, the fact that they have been able to exploit our desire for cheap goods, and they have used that for the building of their military and their also global hegemonic vision, which is called the One Belt, One Road strategy. So the only way that you can slow China down is to defeat them economically, and that's what President Trump is trying to do, bring our supply chains back here, isolate China economically, and I believe that he is going to force a collapse on them, and that's why they are panting. I think they're panicking right now because they know they cannot keep up with this type of situation economically.
They say they'll not be blackmailed and they'll never give up. So we'll see about
that.
Good. So
they'll go the way of the Soviet Union.
So what would you expect Trump to be doing over the next few days?
I will expect President Trump to be building up a firewall around China, all of these other countries. And I believe that the European Union will also, they'll come to their senses. And I think China will find itself on the outside looking in when all of a sudden they realize that we're not going to be able to get all of these goods into the United States anymore. And that's going to affect us even more economically. We see what's happening in the Panama Canal. So the One Belt, One Road strategy is going to start to retract. It's going to start to shrink. And I think it'll force that collapse if they continue to try to stand against us, which they're not going to be able to do. Our economy is much stronger than the Chinese economy.
And we're about to find out, too, because they want to make their military stronger than our military. And the EU going
Correct.
With zero tariffs, everyone thought that would be a green light. What he said is no. You don't take our cars, you don't take our beef, you don't take our farm products, and you got the VAT tax, which throws off everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And let's remember that the EU was created, the European Union was created to help the European countries be a stronger trading mechanism against the United States of America. Now, all of a sudden, if they are not able to show that type of strength, then they have to start questioning what's the viability, what's the reason for having this European Union. So they are also in a very untenable position.
So I got an announcement for you. We're going to be coming to Dallas with History, Liberty,
cool.
and Laughs. And we are all set. It's going to be, we're going to announce tickets soon, but it'll be August 23rd. We'll be in Dallas, Texas. We'll announce the venue shortly. So don't make any plans for August 23rd or change them.
All right. You know, I'll just sit tight and I'll just wait.
That's all I ask. And tell the Dallas County Republicans we're coming. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, thanks so much.
My pleasure. See you in August.
You got it. Back in a moment with Jonathan Turley.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So this news was welcome news from the Supreme Court yesterday as they lift the order blocking President Trump from deporting Venezuelans under the Alien Enemies Act and temporarily halts the deadline to return the suspected MS-13 member back to the U.S. Now, the Aliens Enemy ruling, which went into effect in the 1790s, also said this: the detainees must be given time to challenge their detentions via habeas corpus claim and be able to challenge whether the act is being lawfully applied. So joining us now to unwind all this is Jonathan Turley, George Washington University professor, JB and Maurice C. Shapiro, professor of public interest at GWU. Jonathan, your reaction to the ruling?
Well, it's a significant win for the Trump administration, both on a political and legal level. This is Judge Bosberg's case that has been so much in the news. And it turns out that, as many of us suggested early on, he should never have heard the case to begin with. He should not only not have issued these orders, he should have rejected the case. The Supreme Court strongly indicated that this was a case of form shopping, that the challengers came to D.C. looking for a favorable judge, and they found one. And the court says, take yourself to Texas. Now, once they're there, this will be treated as a habeas case, which once again is what a lot of us said at the outset. You know, the challengers were somewhat ambiguous as to what is the nature of this case. They suggested it might be a problem under the Administrative Procedures Act, which some of us thought was very unlikely, or it might be a habeas case. It always looked like a habeas case to some of us, and that's what the Supreme Court said. Now, the problem with that is that I don't see how they can prevail under habeas. So they'll get their due process, but I don't see how any of them are very likely to come out ahead in the long run.
So let me give you a scenario. I have somebody I'm suspected. You know, I feel as though I'm ICE. I picked him up. I give him to the local police or vice versa, and I put him in jail. And he's got the neck tattoo on, and the indications is TDA. But I don't have an airtight case, right? But am I going to have to deal with the fact that this TDA guy who came here illegally, who's suspected of multiple crimes, and we know what they're capable of with that organization, now they're going to be lawyered up by some left-wing organization, and they're going to get their day in court. And now we're going to have all these criminals who are going to be treated like Jonathan Turley and Brian Kilmeade.
Well, they will get their day in court. That's very clear in this opinion. The court was unanimous on that point. All nine justices said, you've got to give them their day in court. And yes, that'll take some time, but ultimately it's not going to likely result in any benefit for these detainees. The vast majority of these people have criminal records. Some of them have already lost in immigration courts. And so I think that the end result is not going to change. The administration would be wise just to go ahead, move them through the habeas system. Yeah, it'll take a little time, but in the end, you're still going to prevail. And I think that's better for the administration than to try to continue to short-circuit this thing. Now, Congress can pass new laws that allow for even further expedition. But at this point, I don't see how many of these people are going to offer substantial habeas claims.
Why? Why don't you think they're going to get some activist lawyer from the ACLU to drag this thing out?
Well, because despite getting a lawyer, the vast majority of these people do have criminal records, and it's very clear that they can be deported. The only issue is to get a court to recognize that fact. These hearings tend to be very, very brief. They'll probably appeal, but once again, the Court of Appeals tend to give rather light treatment on this stuff once they lose at the lower court. So I just don't think having, you know, can they drag it out? Yeah, they can continue to file things, but I'm not too sure how long they can get away with that. I think that these people will be on their way out of the country.
What about grabbing the other guy out of El Salvador and bringing him back? Because as an MS-13 person in 2019, as ruled by a judge, they thought his security would be jeopardized if he went back to the country he came from.
Yeah, that's a pretty weird case because it was obviously a mistake. It was an unforced error by the administration. They shouldn't have done it. The best thing would have been just to immediately bring him back, put him through the system, and then get him out. The reason for that is that the only reason he was allowed to stay in the country is that he had this special status that the court gave him to allow him to stay in the country pending further resolution. Once MSNBC was declared a terrorist organization, people associated with MSNBC.
MS-13, no, right?
MS-13.
MSNBC, a terrorist organization. You just made a huge headline there.
But once MS-13 was declared a terrorist organization, members of that organization no longer are entitled to that status. So things have changed. And so if they had simply brought him back, they could have gone to a court and said, look, we have a previous ruling that there's evidence here on MS-13 association. MS-13 is now a terrorist organization. So your earlier order is invalid because he can't use that device.
The weird thing is, if he's MS-13, why are you picking and choosing which is a street gang? Well, why are you picking and choosing what country we could send it to? Like, why does he get any rights to choose the country to be deported to?
Yeah, he was arguing that other gangs would be threatening him. And the court seemed inclined not to rule in that way. It just gave him this status that allowed him to appeal further. But he no longer has the right to claim that if he's MS-13. So if he came back to the country, I think that they would make short work of this. But the biggest problem is he's out of the country in a foreign prison.
Yep.
I don't think the court does have jurisdiction to force them to bring him back. And it may go to the Supreme Court. There's a really significant procedural problem here, and jurisdictional one. And I think the court must realize that when they issued this order. The Supreme Court could very well say, look, this was a dumb mistake. It should never have happened. But he's in a foreign prison, foreign country, and we can't order the U.S. government to bring back someone from a foreign government's prison.
Right, even though we're paying him $6 million to house these guys, maybe more. Jonathan Turley, thanks so much. Unfortunately, we need you a lot these days with all these injunctions. Go get him, Jonathan.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the show. It's a Brian Kilmeade show coming your way this hour. We're going to be joined by General Jack Keane and Matthew Brunnerman. He's at the Nassau University Medical Center chief, and the FBI looking into allegations that the state is taking money away from this state-run facility, and a full-blown investigation is underway. And this could be just the beginning. And we know the problems the state has had with the medical community. General Jack Keane, what's happening with Iran or Ukraine, and the disappointing but not surprising posture of Russia. And then we'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's been a bad 3 weeks for the Houthis, and it's about to get worse. It's been a devastating campaign, whether it's underground facilities, weapons manufacturing, bunkers, troops in the open, air defense assets. We are not going to relent.
Middle East turmoil. The president's decision to pound the Houthi rebels for the last 15 days has helped Iran militias to put down their arms, reportedly, according to Reuters, and the Iranian regime to talk. Yep, this Saturday. This, along with the latest on Gaza, will bring you to the Middle East.
Number two.
This is a massive legal victory, Jesse, a massive victory for law and order and for our constitutional republic and the sovereignty of the United States of America.
There you go, Caroline Leavitt. Judge Fair has landed in the lap of the Supreme Court again. And for the Trump team, the results are two wins. We'll explain.
Number one.
Virtually every country wants to negotiate. If I didn't do what I did over the last couple of weeks, you wouldn't have anybody wants to negotiate. We would have gone to these countries who want to talk, and they were, well, we don't want to talk. Now they're coming to us.
1,200. The market's up 1,200 points. Judge Fair has landed, as I mentioned, the Trump tariffs have gotten the entire world's attention, and the offers of new deals are flooding in. The question for me and for the markets, does the president want a quick deal? Does he want another deal? Or would you rather have the revenue from the tariffs? Clearly to me, he's leaning towards getting a deal. And that's what Scott Bessent, who's on the side along with Kevin Hassett, of people to say, look, there's an imbalance in trade. A lot of these are allied nations. They've never gotten a wake-up call like this before, and they're responding. Others like Lutnick on the commerce side and others who helped design this, Peter Navarro, feel differently. I want you to hear a little from Scott Bessent yesterday, which has the market up 1,000 points. Cut five.
I haven't seen anything from them, but Larry, I can tell you that there are 50, 60, maybe almost 70 countries now who have approached us. So it's going to be a busy April, May, maybe into June. And Japan is a very important military ally. They're a very important economic ally. And the U.S. has a lot of history with them. So I would expect that Japan's going to get priority just because they came forward very quickly. But it's going to be very busy. And if President Trump, again, gave himself maximum negotiating leverage. And just when he achieved the maximum leverage, he's willing to start talking.
And there's a few things going on right now. The only people who retaliated are those idiots up in Canada who are this left-wing leader is trying to get reelected. He wants to be a tough guy. He's actually hurting his country, but he'll realize that soon. And then China, who the president said they retaliated at 34%. And he essentially said if they do anything more, he's going to go up to 107%, 104% total. Vietnam has come to the table. They got hit by 46%. South Korea is trying to negotiate right now. In fact, this Truth Social just got posted. He said, I had a great call with acting president of South Korea. We talked about their tremendous unsustainable surplus, tariff, shipbuilding, large-scale purchase of U.S. LNG, that's natural gas, their joint venture on the Alaskan pipeline, and the payment for the big-time military protection we provide them. And he goes on, it looks like South Korea wants to do a deal, and as do we. Taiwan offered concessions already. We know the United Kingdom trying to negotiate. Switzerland, same thing. Offered concessions. Thailand trying to negotiate. Malaysia, Singapore trying to negotiate. Brazil trying to negotiate. The retaliation is really only China. So game on. We'll see what happens. With the European Union, they said zero tariffs. And we said, not good enough. Patrick Bay Davids, an inspirational speaker. He also is a very successful multimillionaire. He does value. He's a Valuetainment founder. He was on last night, and he talked about what the tariffs mean to business. Cut eight.
I think he's doing it the right way because you're steering the pot to see who's going to be the first. 50 people are calling us. Vietnam already agreed. Another country already called. There has to be a spirit of competition and urgency where everybody's moving. If he does it methodical, one by one by one, one could slow it down. And on top of that, if you don't do it fast now collectively, midterms around the corner, then what happens with midterms? So then that's going to be a bloodbath at midterms if they're not executing this accordingly in a very urgent manner.
So the midterms are. That's why he wants to do it now. And then if you get the big, beautiful bill by the spring / summer, they really expect the economy to hit full stride. Now, when it comes to peace in the Middle East, it's a little bit more complicated, but it is moving. I mean, my goodness, you let Israel do what they did in Lebanon to do in Gaza. They now control 50% of the Gaza Strip, which is important. They don't want to rule it. They want to control it want to rid it from terrorists. And if they can clear and hold, that was what David Petraeus was recommending a while ago. And guess who stopped it? Joe Biden. He wanted them in. He wanted them out. So now Benjamin Netanyahu is making some progress. Cut 20.
The hostages are in agony. And we want to get them all out. Steve Witkoff, President Trump's very able representative, helped us get a deal that got 25 out. We're working now on another deal that we hope will succeed. And we're committed to getting all the hostages out, but also eliminating the evil tyranny of Hamas in Gaza.
And sadly, they're not coming clean and turning over a new leaf. They got to be killed because they're trying to kill the IDF. They're also trying to kill the Palestinian people and keep them intimidated, and they're beginning to rise up. So I think some real progress is made by Israel. But the question is, what are they going to do about Iran? There's a window of opportunity to get rid of their nuclear program. I think the president realizes that, too. That is why the prime minister was there yesterday. And Iran has come to the table. They'll meet in Oman on Saturday. I don't know who we are sending. I'm not sure who they are sending, but they say it's going to be higher ups. We say they're direct talks. They say they're indirect talks, which essentially is split the difference. They're going to be in the same building, separate rooms with an intermediary, passing notes back and forth. Because we don't have relations with them for the last 40 years, really since 1979. I was surprised to hear that. But Trump is going at a million miles an hour. That's why at 4 years, he just wants to have no regrets. Here's what he's saying. Cut 16.
I think if the talks aren't successful with Iran, I think Iran is going to be in great danger. And I hate to say it. Great danger, because they can't have a nuclear weapon.
So is that a yes?
You know, it's not a complicated formula. Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That's all there is.
So
can't
the
have
US
it.
Ready,
right now, we have countries that have nuclear power that shouldn't have it.
We have huge B-2 bombers amassing right in the Persian Gulf. And their aircraft, they sent the B-2 Spirit aircraft to Diego Garcia right in the Indian Ocean. The long-range bombers are suited to evade Iranians' air defense and can carry America's most potent bunker-busting weapons. You don't think Iran knows that? And you don't think we want them to know it? Of course we do. All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, inside an outrageous scandal brewing on Long Island that could affect everybody here and around the country. The FBI probing a bombshell claim. We'll have that and more on what we just discussed in the Middle East and Ukraine with General Jack Keane. And then we'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. Big hour. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories. It's Brian Kilmeade. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and joining us now is Matthew Brunnerman, the Nassau University Medical Center chief, who took over a couple of years ago, at which time this hospital on Long Island was just getting hammered, was buried in debt, and they managed to borrow their way out, but not before revealing somebody on the take to the point where the FBI could be looking at a massive investigation. And Matthew, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me.
First off, why would a successful businessman like you try to turn around a hospital?
Well, very good question. I question myself every day right now why I agreed to do this. But the truth is my last child went off to college. My wife and I, who actually like each other, were empty nesters. And I decided, you know, I was raised with gratitude. And my family and I have been very blessed. And I wanted to give back to the community and wanted to donate my time to fixing things. And I have healthcare experience and business experience. And Bruce Blakeman told me that there was this hospital for the needy that was broken for decades. And of course, that was a challenge accepted. And I stupidly stepped in.
Well, stupidly, but you're being sarcastic. You ended up turning an $11 million profit. But what did you find when you got there?
So when I got there, it was really like I was dumbfounded. I have no political governmental experience. You know, I was a business person, like a lot of people you hear about with Doge and Musk and Trump and these other guys that come into politics and government. And in my own little microcosm, I saw it exactly. And when I walked in the door, I said, you know, hey, can I get the current financials on the very first day? And, you know, they were like, well, they hand me these numbers and they were a year and a half old. And I was like, no, like current. They said, these are our most current financials. I said, okay, well, do you have an audit? The audit was a year and a half old. I was like, do you have a budget for this year? No budget. I said, can you get the CFO and bring him in here? We don't have a CFO. I mean, when I walked in, it was like a disaster. And I, you know, it was just a real mess.
Supposed to get $100 million from the state, right?
Yeah, so for 2024, we have a three-page piece of paper from the New York Department of Health that simply says that we should be receiving, Nassau University Medical Center should be receiving $100 million. And it breaks it down, $50 million from the Fed, $50 million for the state matching share, and $100 million total should be coming to the hospital.
And how much came?
50.
Where'd the rest go?
So, in New York State's pocket. So when I looked at it again, just trying to figure out, hey, where are my revenue streams coming from? All right, we have a hospital, we have a nursing home, we service the prison under contract. These are all of our different areas where revenue comes from. And what, and some of those places for a hospital were, you know, these different governmental programs that are designed to, for a safety net hospital, which is what we are. It's a special designation for, you know, the needy, for everyone to be able to access healthcare in this country, regardless of their ability to pay. That's our mission. So I'm going through it, and some of the revenue streams are from state, federal, and other government agencies for, you know, covering these people that can't pay. And it, as I'm going through it, I look at this DISH program. I'm trying to figure out, how do I get more? You know, we're going through it, and the staff tells me, I said, well, it says last year we got $50 million of cash. This piece of paper says 100. Like, what happened? And then that's where they were like, well, we have to post our money up to the state, and then we put that money back, and then we get the money down. And I'm like, this is like a person on welfare having to subsidize themselves. Like, what are you talking about? If you're on welfare and you're supposed to get $1,000 a month, you're supposed to put up $500 to get $500. Like, something stinks. And that started my process to figure out, like, what's going on here. And obviously I found what I found.
So you found what? Money was going to the Cayman Islands?
Yeah. So basically, a hospital is self-insured, generally. You know, we have doctors, lawyers, we deliver babies. There's a lot of malpractice litigation. And so rather than have an insurance company cover something, the losses for something that big, we do something called self-insurance. And so our insurance agency, the biggest in the country, they process everything, they do all the work. And then we have an insurance reserve offshore that's calculated with them to cover these malpractice claims should we win and have to pay. And at the time in Bermuda, we had and that's just part of the industry with insurance, but we had about $46 million offshore.
And it wasn't, you didn't have access to it.
No. And so what it is, and again, this is, you know, I'm a business guy. So when I buy a company, I'm always looking for how someone's trying to get over, where's the fraud.
But Matt, why would be offshore? Like, why wouldn't it be in your account? Like, why is it there? Did anyone ever give you an answer why you were there, why it's in the Cayman Islands?
No. And frankly, like, I'm not sure that that was as nefarious as the thing that I knew that they realized was that when they put this all together, the state was under common control. The hospital was basically a victim. It's like having someone locked in your basement. The board of the hospital is comprised of 50% of the people are appointed by the state, 50% by the county, and then all the executives and the chairman are appointed by the county. So before Blakeman was involved, it was under
he's the Nassau County executive
rule. Yes, yes. So before the Nassau County flipped and became Republican and Bruce came in for you know, a decade beforehand, you know, it was there was a single party, you know, it was Democrats in the state and Democrats in the county. And they had the ability to dominate the hospital and kind of set this scheme up. And what was interesting is that they chose a pile of money that wasn't on our balance sheet. So it wasn't on the books of the hospital. It's to our benefit, but it was hidden offshore, which was like very Enron-esque.
So when you gave this to Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, you expected to get a medal, but what'd you get?
Yeah, no, I got retaliation. Like, they started putting false things about my family and me in the newspaper. They attacked me. You know, they sent their henchmen in to talk to me and tell me I'm never going to win and I'm messing around in New York politics and I don't know what I'm in for. All the threats that they gave me were purported they were my friend. So I would get, like, the head of NYFA, Richie Kessel, would take me to lunch and tell me I have no idea what these quote unquote people would do to me and how dangerous this is and how I should get out of it. And, you know, and they literally just turned it into an assault and threat on me. And then they put out false information in the local newspapers. I'm sitting here. I took it from $180 million loss when I walked in the door to a $11 million profit. We increased access to care because a lot of our people are hourly. So we made nighttime hours, weekend hours. When I got here, Meg Ryan and her team took the hospital from a D rating nationally for our healthcare scores to a C. Like, we fixed up the whole place. We lit it up like a beacon. We turned the finances around. We increased collections last year alone, Brian, by $47 million.
So you do all this, they're attacking you, and now you got Kash Patel's attention?
Yeah, so I'm cooperating right now with the DOJ and the FBI, and we'll see what they think about it.
And if you've told this story and the fundamentals, do you think he's going to pick up the case?
100%. And Brian, look, I'm not a healthcare lawyer, but I am a very seasoned executive and know the law. I went out and I know accounting. Grant Thornton, which is our auditor, has seen this and agrees with it. I hired, it was very funny because it took a little cajoling, but I managed to get the former general counsel of the New York Department of Health and who's also the former ethics chair of New York State. I got that lawyer and his law firm to write me a legal opinion agreeing. So this isn't like off the top of my head. I'm certain that this is a total violation. It's a huge cover-up. It's totally corrupt. And the worst part,
Kash Patel's from the neighborhood, so the FBI director is onto it. Matthew Bruderman, best of luck, though, on the way. We'll be sure to track this story, written up in the New York Post today by the end Newsday.
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I'm not happy about what's going on with the bombing. They're bombing like crazy right now. They're bombing. I don't know what's happening there. That's not a good situation. So we're meeting with Russia. We're meeting with Ukraine. And we're getting sort of close. But I'm not happy with all the bombing that's going on the last week or so. Horrible. It's a horrible thing.
As predominantly the Russians, and they are still going over the energy sector, at one point we're going to have to cut bait. General Jack Keane knows all about it, retired four-star general, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War. If you want to know the latest, sign up for ISW. General, your thoughts about what the president just said. Nothing's really slowed down, has it?
Well, yeah. I mean, compared to the way it was, it has slowed down somewhat. But look, at the real issue here is Russia stalling. And, you know, they don't want to go to even a temporary ceasefire, and they're certainly a lot further away from the idea of any kind of a deal. And they believe that by stalling, it'll put more pressure on the Trump team, and they'll be granted concessions. That's what this is all about. Zelensky and the Ukrainian people want a ceasefire, and they're willing to go to a peace agreement that's fair. And President Trump, same thing. There's only one Putin, and we've got to come to that realization. So what's the alternative? We got to think about really slapping some really hard sanctions on Russia that will cut back on his oil and gas and hit his central banks. And also, we got to upgun Ukraine. Those are the two major options available to the Trump administration to put pressure on them. I think it's about time we started moving in that direction.
Are Russia making gains?
No, small tactical gains. They've been trying to take Pokrovsk for almost a year now, and they still haven't taken it, to give you a sense of how small these tactical gains are. Drones are the killer on the battlefield, and they pretty much reduced this to positional warfare and something of a stalemate, because if you can be seen by the drones, then you can be killed. And tanks are vulnerable, armored vehicles are vulnerable, artillery is vulnerable. You know, there's no countermeasure yet that's been developed for drone warfare. There will be, and the United States is working on microwave and also directed energy lasers. But right now, warfare has changed, and drones are definitely dominating.
And it changed within this war, could you correct? This is where we've really seen it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Ukrainians have taken drone warfare to another level, way beyond anything the United States had contemplated. And we're taking lessons from them and learning those lessons. And I know the ground force, the chief of staff of the Army, General Randy George, is making major changes in the United States Army based on the lessons learned from the war in Ukraine.
So, yeah, so we're seeing that. We also, what are they doing themselves? Have they begun to construct their own weapons?
Yeah. I mean, they made 1.5 million drones in 24 and 25. They intend to make 5 million. And they're also building other weapons capabilities. I mean, they're not making their own tanks yet or their own artillery pieces. But in terms of missile developments, they are. So they're building a defense industrial base, which is really what they should be doing. You know, they want to be able to sustain themselves going forward. Certainly, they know full well that Putin's aspirational goal is to topple Ukraine. Even if there is a peace agreement, Ukraine looks at that as a temporary pause, and Russia will rearm and reattack at a time that's convenient to them, likely when President Trump is no longer president of the United States. So, yeah, they're building their own defense industrial base to be able to sustain themselves for the future.
And at the same time, is there a part of Russia that does want to pause? Do they think it's to their advantage to continue to fight?
No, Russia knows full well that in 2025, they're going to have major problems. Personnel mobilization is likely because they can't sustain the casualties they're taking. And they're averaging 100 to 150 tanks lost a month, and they can only replace them with 25 to 30. So they know they're going to have material problems in 25 and personnel problems. And that is one of the reasons why he's trying to get as much concessions now as possible. And, you know, the thought that Russia's just going to overwhelm Ukraine is a huge exaggeration, and it's part of the Russian playbook to give people the impression because they're on offense, they're dominating Ukraine. It's just not true.
So so does Russia also know, by the way, the Ukrainians are coming to town to finalize the rare earth deal that was initiated about a month ago. Do the Ukrainians now feel as though there's a threshold for them? Have the Europeans filled the gap? Because I think we have slowed down our weapons, right?
Yeah, well, they're, right now, the weapons that have been moving into Ukraine are the weapons that were designated by the Biden administration. And if the Trump administration doesn't step up and continue those weapons, then essentially the United States has cut off aid to Ukraine. Yes, the Europeans have stepped up. As you probably have seen, they're increasing their defense budgets. The Secretary General of the UN, Mark Rutte, has called for a 3% standard, no longer the 2% standard, percentage of GDP on defense. So they recognize full well that they've got to do more themselves. And I think the pressure that the Trump administration has put on the Europeans is a good one in that sense, and they are responding. And the administration, while they put pressure on the Europeans, there's no discussions in the United States, any serious discussions among policymakers of pulling away from NATO. They don't intend to do that. They recognize that that alliance has been vital and it has provided stability and peace in Europe all these years. And they also are very much aware of what Putin's long-range objectives are, which is to move into Eastern Europe as part of the Russian Empire. So NATO is essential going forward, but it has to do more for itself, and it looks like they're moving in that direction.
So we'll see what happens, and we'll see if the European leaders will step up or if they're capable of. Lastly, before we move on to the Middle East, do you think that the Europeans, have they proven to you that they are serious about bolstering their own defense?
When you look at the organizations, from a policy perspective, in other words, committing more to defense. But when you look at their organizations, and I was in Germany a few weeks ago talking to our commanders, you know, who deal with the European military. And there's a lot of hollowness there in their forces in terms of proficiency, training standards, even leadership. So we're doing a lot to insist on them, and we have some supervision over their land forces to insist on them meeting standards, and we're imposing those standards on them in a rigorous way for the first time. So to be frank about it, they have a way to go to get to the kind of standards you need to have in an effective fighting force. And certainly their capabilities atrophied for years. I mean, we're talking about 20-plus years here, you know, where they these social democracies were putting emphasis on entitlement programs in their countries at the expense of defense. So yeah. now they're trying to play catch up to that because of the Russian threat. And there's a ways to go.
So let's talk about Iran. They're coming to the table on Saturday, and we made it clear yesterday that if from here on in, if the Houthis hit our ships, it's like Iran hit our ships, and we're linking the two. First off, have we been effective over the last 14 days hitting the Houthis? And number two, what do you expect to happen on Saturday?
Well, first of all, yes, we have been effective hitting the Houthis. This is a challenging target. And, you know, they were at war with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the UAE for almost 8 years, a little bit less on the UAE side. And they conducted, the Arabs conducted an air campaign against the Houthis. The Houthis, after all, toppled the government in Yemen that was friendly to the United States and to Saudi Arabia and the Arabs in general. But they developed resiliency during that time, Brian. They put a lot of their infrastructure underneath the ground. So it's been a challenging target, not an easy target, but yes, systematically we are taking them in a consequential way that has not been done in the past. It will take some time, to be sure, but progress is being made, and so much so that now the government of Sana'a in Yemen, they are starting to move against the Houthis on the ground, and they haven't done anything like that in a number of years. So they recognize this vulnerability there in where the Houthis are up in the mountains. So, yes, progress is being made. It's slow, though, because of the nature and challenge of the target itself.
In the terrain.
In terms of this Saturday, I think it remains to be seen how serious the Iranians are. You know, their tactic in the past.
Maybe they'll be vulnerable. Thanks, General Jack Keane.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, welcome back, everybody. We're going to be on with Stuart Varney shortly, but at the back end, I might be able to squeeze in some calls if we don't go right to the post, which I don't think we will. 1-866-408-7669. General Jack Keane was saying, good that the Iranians are talking, but not many people, just to finish up what he was saying, not many people are that optimistic when you talk about the Iranians actually sincerely being at the table. Remember, when they did a deal last time, there were no weapons inspectors, no on-site inspectors, and after 10 years, the whole deal would evaporate, and still that was a struggle. I don't know what's changed. You know, John Kerry's not involved, Barack Obama's not involved, but we know when they were done with that deal, Chuck Schumer didn't vote for it, only 42 senators voted for it. But let's
I think he's
to
doing
it.
A different broadcast.
Yeah.
You're on with us now, Brian. Okay. The Supreme Court ruled Trump is allowed to enforce the Alien Enemies Act that helps him deport criminal migrants. I think this is a Trump win. But, Brian, the migrants have to go through due process. That means it'll take longer, right?
That's my problem, and that I'm not. I don't say I want anyone in the El Salvador prison that is not guilty. I don't want that. Nobody wants that. But if we're in a situation where we have 8 million illegal aliens, 2.5 million gotaways, that is just during the Biden years, and now we have these people embedded in our communities who are lethal killers. Now we're going to see them in jail. Then they're going to get their day in court. We know the ACLU and other left-wing organizations supported by George Soros will probably lawyer them up. And then they're going to have an appeal, perhaps, after they get tried. And also, when you're out in the field and you're trying to collect information on foreign gangsters, you got to hope they're coming from a country that's going to supply their background and their criminal record. You know, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, they're not really too forthcoming about their criminal records. So all of a sudden, you're going to be embroiled in a case that American citizens are entitled to. But I just don't know in different process. So now they're going to get regular proceedings, which I think we're going to all find very frustrating. Although I don't want someone in an El Salvador prison that doesn't belong there. Right. My sense is you got to trust ICE, law enforcement, and the feds to put together a solid case that they got the right guy. The one other advantage they have is these guys like to label themselves and brand themselves with tattoos. MS-13 like to wear bulls from the Michael Jordan era stuff. That helped lead them there. But I don't know if it's enough to convict them.
All right. I mean, the ACLU lawyers will be all over that kind of thing. They'll just drag it out as much as they can.
Yeah.
It's the way they do it. I know Stephen A. Smith. I watch him, sports guy. Candidate or commentator? Stephen A. Smith, he's sounding more like a politician these days. Watch this, Brian.
With the homelessness, with the crime, with the cost of living in California, I can't imagine Gavin Newsom winning a presidential election with what is going on in the state of California. Obama himself has been popular all of these years. His policies may not be. Congressional seats, Senate seats, gubernatorial seats, all L's all over the place.
Okay, Brian, you think he's going to run for some office somewhere?
Well, put it this way, most of the party's going to the left. He sounds like Bill Maher mostly. In fact, he went on Bill Maher's show and he sounded extremely sensible. I think that if he's serious about it, now's the time to do it. And I continue to go on shows like your show, my show, this network, other networks, and then get engaged and see if it's something you want to mix yourself up in. So just know this. Stephen A. Smith's in a fight with LeBron James right now, and that's divided the basketball community. And he knows what it's like to have 50% of the basketball community against him and 50% with it.
Yeah.
That is nothing compared to politics, where these days 50% of the country is going to dislike you, look to disarm you with arguments. And at the same time, I don't know if he wants to do it. Plus, I think he just signed a $100 million deal to be a commentator in ESPN. Why would he want to give that up for $450,000 and president of the United States? I mean, this is something that gets traction. It gets us talking about it, gets him more notoriety. He's a good guy, thoughtful guy.
Yeah, he's a good
guy.
I
read his book, too. He's very into politics and issues growing up in Hollis, Queens. So he understands both sides of things, self-made success story.
Have we got time to run a clip from the president at the White House yesterday? Roll the tape. No, we haven't got time. Sorry. Brian? You droned on about Stephen A. Smith, and that I just couldn't get the White House, the Dodgers on the show.
Right.
I'm sorry.
They look like they're going to win it all again. How about
We'll get it in later. I'll get it in later. Brian, thank you very much indeed. You're all right.
All right, Stephen A. Smith, I don't think he's going to run for office, but you know the guys, they do want to run for office. They do think that their answer is going to be The Rock. They do think it's going to be somebody that transcends, has a bit of fame. They want to try to capture the Trump situation where people are extremely well-known, because there's not anybody right now outside politics. The Trump came from outside politics that could dominate basically for the last, what are we looking at, 8-10 years. You know, Trump starts running in 2015, thinking about it since 2012, starts running in 2015. Here we are in 2025, so he's been dominant for 10 years. But he was famous prior to that. In fact, most people that he knows will say, I've known him for 30, 40 years, because he's been famous and well-known since he was really 27, 28 years old. And then in his 30s, he goes and buys the New Jersey Generals or the USFL. They have three of the biggest names in football. He starts talking about taking on the NFL. That becomes a huge story with Herschel Walker, Doug Flutie, Jim Kelly, and Walt Michaels, his coach. And he became somewhat of a mogul. So from that moment on, he was really pretty well known, along with buying, hanging out with the elite and buying big and trying to do big things here in New York City. So just a quick note, it's now live for the first time on BrianKilmeade.com. I'll be in Richmond, Virginia in August, I think August 23rd, be January, June 21st in Dayton, Ohio. History, Liberty, and Laughs is all specials with One Nation on Fox Nation. And then we know Politics and Pints tomorrow. That'll be in Richmond, Virginia. That's going to be a big event, and I think there's a handful of tickets still left. So there, you got to find it on your own. Keep it here, the Brian Kilmeade Show. Also, keep in mind too, that when you tune into our show and when you go to that show, there'll be, when you're on our stage show, there's going to be opportunities to get Stay Within Yourself shirts, as well as different Fox Nation specials, which you have my series, What Made America Great, and a lot of other great series, and we'll be carrying a lot of those live, and you see them live stream. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the latest moments of the show, Brian Kilmeade Show. Bottom of the hour, Ron Kibitz joined us, a Columbia University professor with a brain in his head and knows how to push back against anti-Semitism and seen it festering on the college campuses for years, even though this is a perfect day to do it because Mahmoud Khalil, the 31-year-old graduate student who graduated but still living on college campuses, is deciding that he thinks he wants to condemn the past president of Columbia, the past president of Columbia, and Claire Shipman, the new temporary president of Columbia, for not standing up to the federal government while he stands up for Hamas. Just a despicable character. But the clampdown on illegal immigrant activists who have come onto the college campuses has been probably one of the most impressive things that Donald Trump's administration has done. We're also watching the market surge today. I haven't said that in quite a long time. We're up 959 points. We're up over 1,000 a short time ago because it looks as though Kevin Hassett has just come out and said we're going through all of our deals with various governments who are coming forward with opportunities. The retaliations come from Canada, our arch enemy, and now from China. And the president said to China, if you don't rescind your 34% retaliatory tariffs, we're going to go up higher with our tariffs. With us right now is Josh Holmes. He is not paying a tariff to be on our show today. We're not charging you, Josh. I don't care if you came across state lines. This is going to be a free appearance for me and for you.
Well, you know, hardest working man in showbiz, Kilmeade. You always are.
Well, listen, do you have a Ruthless podcast today?
We had one out this morning. Yeah, we talked a lot about tariffs. We had Doug Burgum on the program, Secretary of Interior, explained, I think, a sort of an important context to all of that with American energy independence and how that plays into what we're doing around the world.
So now we're under, we're about $60 a barrel. We're looking at right now, which I know the oil business doesn't love, but the American people do.
Yeah, no question about it. And I think all of this, barrels of oil, everything else, is all supply demand at some level. And the point is to try to get the economy back in a healthier place. I mean, for the last 3 or 4 years, we've had an economy that has basically been an artificial marketplace that has been bolstered by federal government spending to the point where it's completely and totally unsustainable, unfair trade deals around the world that nobody else wants to revisit. And I think that's what the Trump administration is trying to do. Our great equalizer is when we have stuff that nobody else can do. Energy is sort of foremost amongst them. And I was pleased to hear Secretary Burgum talk a lot about that on our program today.
Right. So here is what Kevin Hassett just said that had the market happy. It looks like he's ready. It looks like the president's looking ready to do deals. Let's listen.
I think that right now we're managing a massive number of requests for negotiations. It's actually logistically quite challenging just to go through them. It's something that I've been spending a lot of the time this morning doing because at NSC and NEC, what we have to do is prioritize the meetings for the president. And there are so many to go through that, you know, we're actually getting ready to present a plan for him on, you know, who and when. But yeah, he obviously prioritizes two of our closest allies and trading partners, Japan and Korea. And the word out of those conversations was really out of the positive, and positive really for American workers, American farmers. There are a heck of a lot of concessions on the table. In the end, the president, of course, is going to be the one who decides whether the deal is good enough to change his mind about the tariffs.
Josh, I know, I guess he was the president, say he had a great conversation with the acting president of South Korea. They're looking to move forward. So do you think with every deal from Israel to Cambodia to Vietnam to the EU, you'll see the market respond positively? Could we get back to where we were?
Yeah, I mean, look, this is really encouraging, and Hassett does a great job of laying that all out. I think both from the market standpoint and just from an individual sort of pocketbook standpoint, what you hoped that the president would want to accomplish here is exactly what Hassett just outlined, is bring everybody back to the table. Let's even get a better deal for the American worker and the American taxpayer. That in and of itself, if tariffs are a mean to that end, I think it's universally positive for the market, for all of us. The problem, I think, is in the first few days of rolling this out, there's a bit of a bifurcated message coming out of Peter Navarro and others that essentially said, like, tariffs are good. We love tariffs, and, you know, they should be here forever, and we'll make a lot of money off of them. That's a different message than tariffs are a tool that we use to get a better deal for America. That is that second message that it's a tool is something that's going to inspire a lot of confidence out of the American people and something that's frankly long overdue.
What do you think it is, Josh? Do you think it's a tool or do you think it's a form of revenue? What do you think a week from now, what are we going to conclude?
Well, I think there's definitely two camps within the Trump administration that see it differently. But if you know anything about Donald Trump, you know he loves a deal. He loves to make a deal. You know, he talked last fall to the Business Roundtable where he told a story about the president of France and a tariff back and forth that they had that ultimately he threatened tariffs. And so our tariffs that were charged to American companies were dropped and they all moved forward. I think illustrating that and saying during the campaign what he would do to use it as a tool is sort of something that everybody else has bought into. I know that that Navarro camp resides within this administration, but if you're already hearing Hassett talk about 50 plus countries coming to the table and them beginning to work out the contours of a deal, I mean, we're not even a week old on this, Brian. It feels pretty encouraging.
So right now I'm seeing the top of Mediaite that it looks like Elon Musk is going at it with Peter Navarro, calling the box of rocks a moron. Because Peter Navarro says he's not a car maker, he's a car assembler, meaning Elon Musk, because he gets his batteries, according to Peter Navarro, from Japan, and he gets certain elements of the car from other places. So what do you think Trump's thinking when that happens?
Well, you know, they don't call it the most transparent administration in history for nothing, Brian. They'll wield insults over X and throughout the public discourse. I honestly think there's some health to it within the confines of an administration. I'm not in love with the fact that it spills outside the locker room all the time if I'm in that administration. But it does show a different approach to a whole bunch of different problems. And the president is ultimately getting advice from different areas and different spectrums on the ideological spectrum. And I think that part is healthy. But I tend to sort of augur more towards Elon's view of a lot of this, although the electric car part, I think Navarro's got a point. I mean, that's been my critique of electric vehicle mandates all along, that they just can't be assembled in the United States. It's just a simple fact, at least not now. And so, you know, look, this is all sort of positive. You see market reaction. I think we got a long way to go here, though, Brian. I don't think this is something that is like now solved and like for the rest of the week and in perpetuity. I think there's a huge tax component to that, which we're looking at on Capitol Hill right now as the House Republicans are trying to grapple with that. I think that is equally important to the trade and tariff discussion that we're having in terms of the long-term health of the American economy. And that's ultimately what this administration is going to be judged upon.
So we have Apple users rushing to upgrade their phones. Apple's also ramping up their iPhone shipment from India to the U.S. as it scrambles to avoid steep tariffs. We also know they're trying to scramble to get out of China to over to India. But India's got to come to the table soon. And the EU saying zero tariffs, the president said not good enough, because you still don't take our beef, you don't take our cars. So I'm not sure how long they're going to keep staring each other down. So we'll see what happens there. But when they do an EU deal, the only thing that will be bigger than that would be China. So do you think the president's that upset that China's digging in? I think on some level, the president wants this economic fight.
Yeah, no, I think he does want this fight. And, you know, the great fear with China is that they take their economy right down to the studs rather than admit that they had to have a discussion with the United States about the unfair deal that we're getting. So I do think that's a real consideration. When you look at the EU, they're absolutely right. It's not just a tariff issue. It's about the openness of a marketplace. I mean, the next time you see a Ford driving around the streets of Paris, let me know. Because they're just not there. They don't accept American vehicles. And there's a whole bunch of those pieces that fall underneath that, as Hassett said in that clip you played, I mean, it's complicated. I mean, we're talking about individual pieces within a larger export-import matrix that you're going to have to go through.
It's going to be fascinating to see. And then out of nowhere, the president announced Saturday we're having talks. He says direct. Iran says indirect talks on getting rid of their nuclear program. The last one was just an embarrassment. They had a 10-year sudden sunset on it. They couldn't do visual inspections. They weren't allowed to go to certain areas. And even the Democrats like Chuck Schumer in the Senate and Cardin, they didn't sign off on it. Do you sense that Iran might be legitimately trying to do a Libya and saying, take my weapons, please?
Look, if there's one thing I'm absolutely certain of, is that when you have a democratically held government. Democrats control the president, the White House, and the House. They're going to get taxes wrong. They're going to get spending wrong. They're going to get border policy wrong. And they're going to get Iran wrong. And I think the message that Iran has had from the United States is, well, I don't know, you wait around long enough and see if the political winds change and you can get a pallet full of cash from the next crew. Right. So I think they intend to continue doing what they're doing right up until the point where you have an administration that ensures that they don't. Now, the Trump administration, the first time around, took an incredible bunch of actions that basically just reduced their ability to export their own resources, oil, gas, and others. They limited their bank account. They put huge amounts of sort of anti-import-export controls on Iran, and it limited their ability basically to do and fund Hamas and Hezbollah and all the other problems that we've seen in the Middle East. That was effective. I trust the president's team when it comes to Iran. They got it right the first time. I think they're going to get it right again.
So I don't know if you've noticed or if they pitched you. There's a few books coming out about Joe Biden's administration. Yeah. Turns out no one thinks he was all there. And they're all pointing out different things about the election, dropping out, should he or shouldn't he. The worst scenario happened. You have Joe Biden's team saying, how dare Nancy Pelosi do this? Most people say, how dare she not do this earlier? Why didn't Barack Obama come out? Who was behind George Clooney? You literally have a situation where everyone hates everyone. And nobody ever told the truth when it mattered. And that's when he was in power. Josh, how did they keep this secret? You would say it on your show. People would brush you back on our show. And how dare you treat older people like that? And he's fine. Look at the legislation that'll pass. Now we find out he worked an hour a day and Otto Penn signed most of the legislation. And nobody thought he was all there, from Obama to Clooney to Pelosi. And who knows what Kamala Harris really saw and thought.
Yeah, I mean, look, it ain't a bingo parlor or a place for mom. It's the White House and it's the leader of the free world. And so I think, you know, everybody had the right to be critical of the Biden administration. I think what it is more than anything, though, Brian, is a commentary on the modern Democratic Party, which is stands for basically nothing other than trying to hold power. And they thought their best shot was to run a cadaver in 2024. And they thought just the power of incumbency alone set up against a former president that they were convinced through legal action and everything else would become unpopular enough where it didn't matter basically who is running the White House. And all of those conversations where everybody hates everybody is whether or not basically it is a fortuitous situation for the Democratic Party or not to move on from Joe Biden. It's not about whether Joe Biden can do the job. It's not about whether or not you have ideas that can improve the lives of the American people. It's everything about whether we can hold the White House. And I think that in and of itself demonstrates the bankruptcy, both moral and intellectual bankruptcy of today's Democratic Party that has gotten them into this mess in the first place. If you stand for absolutely nothing, you know, American people are going to see that.
Am I the only one not impressed and figure it's just nonsensical what Cory Booker did? I mean, I don't know what he was standing up for. It wasn't Obamacare. It wasn't, you know, tariffs. What was he doing? I don't get it.
Yeah, this is the Senate filibuster. It's the oldest and dumbest routine that you can do in the United States Senate, which is basically like prove that you can stand there for 24 hours. What made Cory Booker's stunt so dumb is that I don't know what the hell it was for.
Yes.
Like no one can articulate what it is that he was standing up there to do. Like when Ted Cruz did it 14 years ago, it was about Obamacare. It was about our unwillingness to go forward with that as a Republican Party. This had no message whatsoever other than he could do it.
Yeah.
And you see his colleagues walking around being like, oh my gosh, what courage, what a demonstration project. It's like, of what? Like, yeah. I mean, I guess it takes a lot to stand there for 24 hours and not pee your pants. And he did that very successfully.
So Bill Maher had a point on this past show. I can't wait to see his review of his meeting with President Trump when he went to the White House with Kid Rock. But he had a point this weekend. He said the one thing that Trump showed everybody is you got to be authentic. Whatever it is, Trump's Trump. That's where he is, on or off camera, on the golf course or in the boardroom. Got it. So when I see Cory Booker and I see Gavin Newsom, I see actor.
They're acting.
There's nothing real there. I see Governor Shapiro. I think he seems pretty authentic. Senator Fetterman, authentic. I don't care what I look at AOC as authentic. But But do you think the American people have really raised their standard? They want to see the real you?
100%. And you can make an argument about how that's changed through social media and access to different silos of information. You know, it's not three nets and three cables anymore. You've got a whole bunch of different choices. And I think that has brought some authenticity to the process that the American people frankly demand. And it's not just Donald Trump. It's everyone who has to demonstrate a certain relatability. And Democrats, because of what I just talked about, because of they have no real compass here whatsoever, they're making it up as they go along. You look at Gavin Newsom, who's all of a sudden having conservatives on a podcast and pretending like he's understanding what they're saying. I mean, this guy's 4 years removed from throwing people in jail for walking the beach.
Absolutely.
It's absolutely nonsensical. It makes no sense. But people can see right through that. I mean, the American people are really deft at looking at context of election, what your message is, who you are. When Kamala Harris stands up there in her one and only debate and says, I'm a champion of small business, having never spent a day in a small business in her entire life, people laugh at it. They think it's funny. It's a punchline. But yet they still are operating in like a 1995 set of rules about how you communicate to the American people. Right. It ain't working out great for them.
I don't even think she worked at McDonald's. I want to get to the bottom of that story. I think Trump was 100% right on that.
He might have been right.
Hey, yeah. Josh, we'll look forward to checking out Ruthless whenever we can on the pod because you're always dropping a new one, and we always look forward to the downloads. Josh Holmes, thanks so much.
I appreciate it, Brian. Thank you.
All right. Meanwhile, we'll be back in just a moment. Bottom of the hour, we'll talk to Ron Kivitz, a Columbia University professor, speaking out about that crazy school. Don't move.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And Max Muncy, I want to congratulate Max. Max, come here. Arms are very strong when I touch them. I'm used to shaking politicians and hitting their arm and it's like jello. And now it's like steel, all these guys.
That was President Trump having fun with the Dodgers. Who, believe it or not, went to the White House. No incidents. Win a championship, go to the White House. Remember 4 years ago? It was a problem every single time. I remember Andrew Giuliani did a great job trying to recruit and get all the champions in, and only a few went in. Then when they showed up, Tom Brady didn't show up because it looked like he was too friendly with Trump. Mookie Betts didn't show up last time the Dodgers won. This time he showed up, reportedly. I didn't see the whole roster, but heard he was there. And the Dodgers just showed up in Los Angeles. Even the president kid around saying, you know, I usually introduce the senators, but I don't like your senators. And everyone laughed. So, and the president loves sports. He knows exactly what's going on. He also, I'm sure, was pulling for the Yankees because Randy Levine's a good friend of his. And he, George Steinbrenner, was a great friend of his. They spent a lot of times personally and professionally. He'd spend it in Steinbrenner's box. But Dodgers were great. They beat him. There's no doubt about it. And they're favored to do it again. When we come back, Professor Ron Kivitz at Columbia University and that new study that shows anti-Semitism is by far the most, the largest reported hate crime in the country.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I have known ever since I was a teacher, you know, first at Cornell, then at Berkeley, and then at Columbia, that it is a very common, not at all surprising opinion among faculty, especially humanities and social science faculty, that Israel was a mistake. Very few people have a rabid view about it, but it's very common at a dinner party to hear somebody just say it, especially if a Jewish person isn't there. And it was very common when I was a graduate student, when I was at Stanford. That was a very ordinary view. And it's not that these people would want to see Israel pushed into the sea, but their idea was Israel shouldn't have happened, and how Israel treats Palestinians now is something like a genocide. That did not shock me a year ago the way it shocked many people.
And that
because if you're in university culture, you know that that's long been the standard.
And that is Columbia Professor John McWhorter, who's got a book out now, came into our studio last week and said that is the feeling on Columbia's campus, which you know ripples right through most elite campuses, especially here in the Northeast. Professor Ron Kivitz knows that. He's a professor at Columbia University and has been spoken out about anti-Semitism on the campus, which sadly is still raging everywhere. Professor, your thoughts about what John McWhorter just said.
Hi, Brian. It's great to be here on your show. Thank you so much for inviting me. It is very sad. It's unbelievably inverted that a staunch ally of the United States, I would say an ally that is on the front lines, fighting for the West, fighting for democracy and the American Republic and democracies all over, and of course for its own life, Israel, is seen and portrayed like that. And it could have very dire consequences, because when you brainwash, when you normalize that type of thinking, that a nation that was formed based on the United Nations decision, a homeland for the Jewish people, a nation that is a democracy, a staunch ally of America and the West, that it is not legitimate, that it was a mistake, that will and could end with a genocide of the Jews in Israel and heaven forbid, and a tremendous weakening retreat of the West.
But do That's you think, but Professor, is he right? I mean, when you talk to your other professor friends, did they not say it to you? But do you think that that's how they feel?
I think there's a lot, you know, with you, Brian, I can be completely frank and honest and direct. I think that is a very, unfortunately, a very common thinking on campuses in the Northeast, in the Midwest, in the in California. I don't think it's everyone. I don't think it's I can't quantify if it's the majority. I think it's very common, and it does not represent at all the thinking of the American people, the thinking of the American body politic, both parties, the thinking of American industry corporations. America does not think that Israel is a mistake. America realizes, I believe, that Israel is a staunch ally of America that has both interests, pragmatic interests that coincide with America, and ideology that coincides, the same way America has with the United Kingdom. But yes, I do think that there are many professors, and it trickles down. It is taught, in fact, to the students.
Well, I'll tell you what, they just did a study, the NYPD put it out, and out of the hate crimes, out of the 57 hate crimes, 31 were against Jews, anti-Semitic. So that is a 54% crime incidence are anti-Semitism in New York City. So the president's cracking down on it on campuses. It hasn't stopped the protests from outside. Your thoughts about Muhammad Khalil. Did you run into him on campus ever? And do you think it's wrong to portray him as a leader of the Palestinian movement and Hamas on campus?
I think he was, look, he's now in a process. He's going to get due process. The courts are involved. I do have confidence in our government, in our way of life, the three branches of our government, the executive, the administration, the legislative, the judicial. I really do. That's so he will have due process, and we'll see, you know, what proof. It is clear that he was either the leader or one of the leaders of QAD, Columbia University Apartheid and Davis. QAD is an organization that has 100 quote-unquote clubs, supposed clubs, that have engaged in vile anti-Semitism on Columbia University that has long crossed the line of free speech. It was not about speech. It was action. It was taking over buildings violently. It was imprisoning or taking captive employees, sending them to the hospital. It was intimidating Jews and non-Jews. And he put himself out as the negotiator for QAD, or one of the leaders. So that would be the answer to my answer to your question. I can elaborate more.
In Grand Central Station, so everybody knows it, it's iconic. There was a big protest against Israel and against for the Palestinians / Hamas yesterday. They basically took it over. So it's just ridiculous to talk about this oppressive organization run by a terrorist organization that suddenly people feel as though they care about. I'm wondering on campus prior to the attacks on October 7th, was there this much anti-Semitism, or did it just unmask it?
I think it unmasked what's going on. I think, unfortunately, for decades in the so-called humanities at Columbia University, it's not just the Middle East department, the Middle East and South Asia African quote-unquote studies that has led that and many of the professors there, but it has been in other divisions or departments, history, across the university, and it has also seeped into, like a cancer, into other departments, other divisions, and it was in the curriculum. Some of the professors who, again, I'll use the quotes, quote-unquote, guarded the encampment, this illegal encampment, that was against Columbia University rules and broke all the rules. Some of the professors that encouraged it, guarded it, prevented other folks like Jewish students from getting into the encampment are professors who are in charge of the core curriculum at Columbia University, literally in charge of the core curriculum. So, yes, I think it was infused into the curriculum in the college, not all schools. You know, there's the medical center, the engineering, the business school where I teach, the life sciences, where we don't have, by large, we don't have these problems, and people are focused on what the universities should be focusing on.
Right.
American kids are coming to these universities to learn how to cure people, how to start a business, how to do big data or AI. But it was something very systemic, and it burst like lava outside.
Professor, I'm wondering, you know, you probably talk to people in the admissions process. It's not your job at Columbia, but how does this guy get in? Why is he a preferred student from Syria, goes to Algeria, goes over to get a job at a foundation in England, and he gets to graduate school? You're going to tell me some kid in Indiana or in Austin, Texas, wouldn't been more apt to fill that spot? Like, why are there so many international students who obviously don't have a great feeling about our country that seem to be getting priority?
So that's a very important question, if I may say, with humility. We have met with President Shafiq, then President Armstrong. Neither one of them is now the president of Columbia anymore. And we have provided them with lists of suggestions. And one of them was, look at the admissions policy. Who is being admitted into the college? Why are you admitting these? What is the constitution? What is the mix and actually the real diversity of these folks? Who is funding these students and these programs? Those are questions that have to be investigated and answered. Brian, it is really important for me to emphasize that this is not just about anti-Semitism and violently chasing off campus, physically and violently chasing off campus. That I saw with my own eyes, Jewish students and Jewish professors telling them go back to Poland. This is not just about Israel, burning Israeli flags, standing in the middle of campus, hundreds of people, like the brown shirts in Germany in the 30s, yelling death to Zionists, death to Israel, all Israelis off campus. This is what we've been seeing, we've saw in Colombia. Now it's calmed down, at least outside. It's not just about that. Mm-hmm. What I'm describing is just the carrier or the virus. It is that is just the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg is that what some of these professors in the college are teaching is Marxist ideology, is teaching to hate the American.
It's unbelievable. And you're paying $70,000 for this. You're paying $80,000. How do you feel about this? Here you are, Ivy League institution, the best of the best, and you have a perfect score in your SATs, top of your class, and you still might not get in. And then they announced yesterday Harvard is so disturbed by the lack of remedial math, of fundamental math for their freshmen, they're now making freshmen take remedial math. Can you believe that? Harvard, you would think that you got to be the top of your class in math and everything else, and you got to teach kids how to do math at one of the world's most famous colleges?
So it is all connected. What you are saying is all connected. What Columbia University, Harvard, I went to Michigan for an MBA and then to Stanford for a PhD. We did not deal with these things. What these universities should be about is about medicine, about entrepreneurship, about AI, about helping this our country, helping the economy, helping the world. So if they focused on that, by definition, we will see less of the anti-West and yes, also anti-Israeli and anti-Republic, anti-democracy type of activities, because those professors and those programs and those students were interested in tearing down the universities. And that's what they've done. They've been tearing down Columbia and other universities. Those students are not interested in courses about entrepreneurship or robotics and medicine or collaboration between the physics department and the and other departments. The more universities come back to that, that is the second stage. What I'm trying to say, maybe with too many words, is I think we're starting to end stage one, hopefully, meaning the vile anti-Semitism, the vile anti-West indoctrination.
Right.
And that includes which students are you accepting? Which professors are you hiring? I think that stage of that surfacing and starting to deal with this is happening. The question now for stage two is what comes next? And what comes next must be a focus, a refocus on realism and actually teaching people things that matter.
So lastly, real quick, the president said you got nine things, Columbia University, if you want to get your funding back. One of which was your curriculum's no longer in control of the Middle East, Near East, your political science department. You're no longer in control of that curriculum. It's going to go to a provost, an independent provost. That's the beginning of maybe getting people to understand that you don't have to be anti-American to get a degree in the Middle East studies. Do you think they'll actually implement this stuff?
So first, I support 100%. If there were more percentages than 100, I would say I would support it more than 100%. But I'm from the business school. I can't say that. There's only 100%. I support that list of demands, those nine demands, 100%. I think there needs to be more later on, such as who's teaching the undergrad, what are they teaching, what is in the curriculum, etc. The question you asked, will these critical, necessary requirements be implemented? I don't know. I wish I could say yes. I wish my knowledge.
$400 million is on the line. If they don't do it, $400 million is on the line. So that'll be.
I know many people at Columbia will not like what I'm saying, but it's a free country and there is free speech. And I'll say what I think. The American taxpayer has a right to know where their money is going and make good use of their money. And the issue is that the money that has been frozen, obviously the medical center, the hospital, the engineering, those need a lot of money, but that's what the American people have at their disposal as a tool. So that's a tool that's been used. It's very easy for Columbia University. They'll say it's hard. It is actually very easy for them to fix it. If some professors in the humanities want to go and strike, the same thing Ronald Reagan did with the air traffic controllers.
Goodbye.
Let them go and strike. And we'll find out the professors want to teach our kids things that are really important and not vile, anti-Western, anti-American, anti-Semitic lies.
Right. Professor Ron Kivitz is going to be demonstrations nonstop and a big sentiment from Muhammad Khalil today as he gets a hearing in Louisiana en route to getting to New Jersey, where he hopes to come back and play a role on crazing tumult in Columbia. Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Ron.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your show and you talking to me today so very much.
It's a national story, even though it's located in New York. Brian Kilmeade Show, back to wrap up this hour. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey, we're back just finishing up this hour. Just keep in mind, you got One Nation. I know it seems like a long time away. One Nation coming up Sunday at 10 o'clock. We're going to have a great roster of guests and some special shows right here on the Fox News Channel. We also got some huge stories. We got some huge events coming up in Dallas, as well as Dayton, Ohio in June, Dallas in August, and in September in Richmond, Virginia. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for more. So we'll continue to keep you updated on what's going on with the market. As we look now, we're up 832 points. So I think that's kind of encouraging. Why is that? Because the president's beginning to indicate that he is willing to cut deals. You know who's indicating to cut deals? Netanyahu started it. And he came out and said, I'm cutting all our tariffs. I don't even know why they were there. I'm cutting them all. And he says, we'll work at a handshake deal to go from 17% with the president just put on and knock it down to zero. Elsewhere, just for those critics who say Donald Trump is favoring Russia again in Ukraine, he's not. He's saying, I'm dealing with them when it comes to, there are a ton of sanctions on them right now. I'm dealing with them when it comes to war. I don't need anything else muddying up the waters, another excuse for them to continue to bomb. And I thoroughly understand that. And hopefully that put that to rest. So the other thing to keep in mind, too, is what's happening on Saturday. And that's the Iranians going to go to Oman. They're going to be direct/indirect talks. I hope Rubio goes. No offense to Steve Witkoff. He's got enough on his plate with the other two things. I don't expect him to get to both sides of the Iranian issue. But I love what Pete Hegseth said in the White House yesterday. Pete was just saying, right now, we've been going after the Houthi rebels, doing so much damage. The Yemeni government, keep in mind, the Houthis don't control Yemen. The Houthi government, it knows that they're outgunned by Yemen. The Yemeni's government knows they're outgunned by the Houthis. And now they're beginning to move into that area a lot because of this. Cut 19.
It's been a bad 3 weeks for the Houthis, and it's about to get worse. It's been a devastating campaign, whether it's underground facilities, weapons manufacturing, bunkers, troops in the open, air defense assets. We are not going to relent, and it's only to get more unrelenting until the Houthis declare they will stop shooting at our ships. And we've been very clear at the Iranians as well. They should not continue to provide support to the Houthis, and that message has been made very clear. So we have a lot more options and a lot more pressure to apply, and we know, because we see the reports, how devastating this campaign has been in them, and we will not relent.
And there's a shot over the weekend that they put out there. So you see the Houthi rebels in the middle of the desert having a meeting of their council, and it got spotted. I'm sure they picked it up by our drones, took them all out, every single one of them. And if you don't think that's significant, I think it's directly related to the fact that the Yemenis are now moving to try to take them out with a brand new campaign. So we'll see if that's going to work. Also, keep in mind, too, and I want to get another report on this, but Reuters is reporting that Iranian-backed militias are considering laying down their arms to avoid President Donald Trump's ire. The ten commanders, an Iraqi official, told this to Reuters due to rising threats from Trump towards Iran. The commanders include commanders from the Kitab Hezbollah, Najaba, as well as Kitab Saeed, and it goes on. They name the last name is usually from the region in which they're from. They told Reuters that U.S. escalated pressure has forced them to consider disarmament. That would be kind of good for the Iraqi government, too, because it has a hard enough time keeping all three of their sects together, Kurds, Shia, and Sunni. But they also have to deal with Iran and their influence. That's where we got to keep a presence there and in Syria, in my view. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.